Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, your moderator for tonight's program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate, professor of economics at Princeton, New York Times columnist, and author of the new book, End This Depression Now. Paul Krugman must not need much sleep, as he has so many important roles and tasks on his plate. He is a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and at the London School of Economics. And as an op-ed columnist and blogger for the New York Times, Dr. Krugman addresses many important issues facing our world today. Dr. Krugman is extraordinary in his insightful and real-time responses to the economic challenges that we face. Professor Krugman's expertise and influence is global. The Asia Times recently called him the Mick Jagger of political and economic punditry. The Economist said he is the most celebrated economist of his generation. In December 2008, Professor Krugman received the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences for that year, 2008, honoring his work in international trade patterns. The Nobel is one of numerous prizes and awards he has received. He is the author or editor of 23 books and more than 200 professional journal articles, many of them on international trade and finance. Professor Krugman is clearly one of the world's top economists, but he has moved into what may be a much more meaningful role in that he has decided to explain economic issues and the causes and effects of monetary and fiscal policy to those of us not schooled in economic theory at the highest levels. I know I am speaking for many of us when I express appreciation for his willingness to make economic policy accessible. I only wish he had been my economics professor as an undergraduate. Professor Krugman has been a columnist for Fortune and has published articles in the New Republic, Foreign Policy, Newsweek, the New York Times Magazine, and of course now for the New York Times. His most recent book is End This Depression Now. His previous work, The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008, were highly praised and became New York Times bestsellers in both hardcover and paperback. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Paul Krugman.
So I like this thing. I'm sure there must be some occasion for it during my talk. Hi, good evening. Again, an honor to be here. This is always a great venue for speaking, a great group of people. I guess I'm supposed to say something uplifting and cheery here. Maybe I'll find it somewhere along the way. So let me actually start with the D word, because in this, the title of my new book, I use the word depression, and some people get shocked. Is it really that bad? And there's a reason. It was not just to shock people and sell books, although that won't hurt if that does happen. Here's what we often talk about: recessions, and a recession has a very specific meaning. A recession is when things are heading down, and so we had a recession from 2007 to the middle of 2009, and at that point, things stopped heading down. At least not everything was heading down. At that point, GDP started growing. About 6 months later, employment started growing, but that didn't mean that things are okay. And if a recession is a period when things are heading down, a depression is a period when things are down. What we call the Great Depression is a period of more than 10 years, which actually encompasses two official recessions and two official periods of recovery, except there was no good times in that period. It was all the Great Depression. Sometimes it was a little bit better, sometimes it was a lot worse, but all through, it was mass unemployment, mass suffering. And that's what we're going through right now. We are now, 3 years into a technical recovery. GDP has been growing, employment has been positive, but it's terrible out there, and it continues to be terrible. We've made only very small progress against the suffering out there. It's not as bad as the Great Depression, which is, so great. That's a great recommendation. Maybe that's an election slogan, right? Not as bad as the Great Depression. But it is really, really bad, and it is bad for an extended period, and we're making very slow, if any, progress in solving it. And let me just spend a couple of minutes just to remind you how bad it is. It's kind of easy. Actually, I'm still a little surprised. Many people do seem to find ways of not quite understanding just how bad it is, because you do look, right? There are stores open. There are people out there. Life goes on. Some of the restaurants are full. But surely, unless you live in an incredibly rarefied circle, you have to know people who are suffering from this really terrible environment out there. You can put numbers to it. Almost 4 million Americans have been unemployed for more than a year. So there are 13 million without jobs in total. There's always some unemployment because the economy is always changing. But people who can't find work for more than a year, that hardly ever happens in normal times. Normally that's a few hundred thousand people. Now it's 4 million, which hasn't happened since the 1930s. Think about what that means. That means lives destroyed. It means families losing their homes, losing their prospects. It means losing hope. we don't have numbers, at least I haven't seen them here. In Europe, which is suffering many of the same problems, and in some places worse, there is an upsurge in suicides, because this is the kind of environment that destroys people's lives. There are young people. The prospects for recent college graduates have never, at least not since the 1930s, been as bad as they are now. You look out there, and the numbers show us, if you think that a college education protects you from the bad stuff, people say, get education is the key. Well, the unemployment rate among recent college graduates is higher than the average national unemployment rate. And if you look at the jobs that recent college graduates are getting, first of all, many of them are part-time, involuntarily part-time, and the wages of college graduates have plunged, the average wages of recent college graduates. That's not because any individual job has seen a drastic cut in wages. It's because an awful lot of recent college graduates have graduated with their heavy load of student debt and then find that all they can get is being a barista at Starbucks, that they're finding that the jobs are just not there. All of this is casting a huge shadow over our society, not just now, but for the future. Many of those people, the longer this goes on, with people who've been unemployed for a year or more, many of those people, some of them my age or older, will never get another job. The more this goes on where there are no jobs for the young, the more of them will never get started on their career properly. And that, so we're sacrificing a lot of our future as well as our present by allowing this to go on. And the thing is, it's all unnecessary. You want a lot of people, it sounds wise and sophisticated and serious to say, stroke your chin. These are deep problems and there can be no quick fixes. But that's all wrong. This is in fact something for which there are quick fixes. There are huge long-term problems with our economy. There have been for a long time. There were lots of things wrong with the U.S. economy in 2007. We had massive inequality. We had a lot of things. 5 years ago, we were not a country that you wanted to say that everything was fine, but we did not have 4 million people who'd been out of work for more than a year. This is, in fact, a very narrow technical failure. It's something for which we could solve it very quickly if only we had the intellectual clarity and the political will. John Maynard Keynes, British economist, long dead, whose work has never been more relevant, had a great essay he wrote in 1930 called The Great Slump of 1930, just as the Great Depression was getting underway. And he tried to convey the point that this was not something that was deep and broad. It was actually something very specific that could and should be solved. And he said, we have magneto trouble, with an old-fashioned word, basically trouble with the electrical system of the car. Think of it as you've got an expensive car which is stalled because it has a dead battery that you could replace for $100. And it really is. That is the problem. It's something that narrow, that straightforward, that could and should be solved very quickly. Now, of course, it's not easy to convince people. It's not easy to convince people in a position of power that that's the case. It's not easy to convince them to do what should be done. And some of them, even if they did believe it could be solved quickly, might prefer not to for a variety of ulterior motives. But the fact is it's something that's easy to solve as an economics matter. Very difficult as a political matter. And in the book, I do say, I try to extend the Magneto analogy a little bit. I say, if your car won't run because it has a dead battery that you could easily and cheaply replace, but your husband refuses to believe that that's what the problem is and refuses to replace the battery and insists that you walk or take buses instead, you have a problem. You may have a big problem. It might even be an insoluble problem, but the problem is not with the car. And that's basically... okay, funny, but this is the reality. So what is the nature of the problem? It is basically that there is not enough spending, that we are not collectively as a society not spending enough on each other's products to keep ourselves fully employed. We kind of understand how that happened. We had a long period when people became too... We went a long period without a severe economic crisis. And particularly the Great Depression faded into the mists of history to the point where lots of people sort of pretended that it never happened and that the things we did to prevent it from happening again were all unnecessary. But anyway, we had a long period of complacency. And what happens in periods of complacency, some people may know this is the Minsky hypothesis, is that people get relaxed about certain kinds of risks. Actually, they get relaxed about all kinds of risks, but what they get relaxed about in particular is debt. They start to forget the dangers of having high levels of debt. For the most part, by the way, this is a problem of private, not public debt. It's a problem of households borrowing too much. We reached a level of household debt relative to income not seen since the 1920s. And somebody should have looked at that and said, hey, you know, 1920s, boy, that's interesting. We reached levels of leverage in banks that were not seen since a long, long time ago. We steadily removed the prudential regulations on banks that were supposed to prevent the kinds of financial crisis that swept the world in the early 1930s. And even more important than the actual deregulation which took place, we failed to extend regulation as banking evolved, as new forms emerged. We should have said we need the same kind of regulation of these new kinds of banking that we had, but we didn't do that. And so there came a point when, you know, the steadily rising levels of debt, and there came a point when people... Well, some people call it the Minsky moment, because after Hyman Minsky, the economist who warned us about this, and not enough people paid attention. I also kind of prefer sometimes it's the Wile E. Coyote moment. For people who are not familiar with the classics, in Roadrunner cartoons, right? Wile E. Coyote always runs off the cliff, and according to the laws of cartoon physics, it's not until he looks down that he falls. And so there came a moment, which was... now almost 5 years ago, when people said, oh my God, too much debt. For the most part, people who were heavily in debt were forced to cut back, to slash spending. The trouble is, if everybody tries to slash spending at the same time, it's self-defeating. And this is another. We've been talking actually about new economic ideas. There's even an Institute for New Economic Ideas, which is doing good work. But as some people have pointed out, a lot of new economic ideas really involves rereading old books because we've been here before. That's part of the point. We've been here before. So another great economist, Irving Fisher, explained all of this in the early 1930s. He said when everybody tries to pay down debt, when everybody tries to spend less, the result is actually self-defeating because my spending is your income and your spending is my income. And if we all try to slash our spending at the same time, the result is that the economy slides into a depression and the burden of debt actually becomes worse because you're trying to pay it down, but your income has fallen and your debt position relative to your income has gotten even worse. And that's the story. That's what happened. It happened to essentially, it's to us and to the Europeans. They really are twin crises. It's almost I sometimes think of it as a North Atlantic crisis rather than a U.S. crisis. The details are different, but the broad picture is pretty much the same. So what do you do in a time like that? Well, the answer is somebody has to spend. Somebody has to make it possible for the people who've overextended themselves to pay down that debt, which means that somebody has to step in and play the role of spender. And that somebody is, in the first instance, it is the government. This is a time for the government to spend. Not because you favor more government spending all the time. That's a different discussion we can have, but that's not the point now. But because somebody has to step in there. We can talk about budget deficits. We can talk about the need to rein in spending or raise more revenue or both, which probably needs to be done eventually, but not now. Again, Keynes, the boom, not the slump, is the time for austerity, he said. For those who say, well, we do need to deal with these issues of debt, and I actually have like to quote St. Augustine here, who said, oh, Lord, make me chaste and continent, but not yet. This is not the time for that because it is literally self-defeating. Try to do austerity now, and it actually just deepens the depression. It actually probably even makes the budget position worse because it shrinks the economy, shrinks revenues, hurts the future. It's just a deeply destructive thing. So this is the time for government to spend. A lot of people just won't believe, a lot of important people just won't believe this, and they offer all kinds of reasons why this must be a much deeper problem than that. It must be structural. It must be deep problems with the economy. I just put up a blog post this afternoon about the latest, which was, well, the trouble is, you know, that we have unemployment in the places that had housing booms, and if you do more spending, it won't create jobs. You know, it's too blunt. It won't create jobs where they're needed. And the actual example given was, well, if you spend money in New York, is that going to create jobs in Nevada? Which would define if the story were, in fact, that we had a few small pockets of high unemployment in this country. The fact of the matter is, yeah, Nevada is really bad. But New York has an unemployment rate of 8.5% right now. It's not as if we have any, yes, we do have a small area that's prosperous. It's Nebraska and the Dakotas. It's basically a fracking boom. Combined population about the same as that of Brooklyn. To put more of a number on it, how much of the American population lives in states where the unemployment rate is above 7%? The answer is 3/4 of us live in states where it's above more than half in states where it's above 8%. This is a very widespread thing, and only 8% of Americans live in states where the unemployment rate is below 6%. So this is a vast sea of unemployment with a few pockets that are not doing quite so badly. The point is that this is something, it is not structural, it's not workers in the wrong places, it's not workers with the wrong skills. Yes, of course, there's always a mismatch between the skills of workers and the skills that employers want, but there's no indication that it's any worse than normally it is. And everyone who tells you that, well, we've got mostly the wrong kind of workers or anything like that, the question is, who's doing well? If the problem is that workers don't have the right skills, then the workers with the right skills must be doing well, right? So which occupations are actually thriving in America right now? The answer is none. You can find here and there some very, very specific skills, but this is all across the board. So we need to spend more, not spend less. And then somebody says, well, what about the deficit? Deficits can be a problem, but really not now, not at a time like this. And every time somebody says, well, where will the money come from? The markets are willing to lend the U.S. government long term. The interest rate on 10-year bonds was about 1.75% last time looked today. Which is what you would expect because we have a situation where everybody's trying to spend less, trying to pay down debt, and the trouble is no one is willing to spend. So we actually have, in effect, a lot of saving, a lot of money looking for someplace to go. And the U.S. government, which is solvent in the long run, is a place that can borrow. It can spend more. It can boost our economy. This is not the time to be worrying about deficits. And anyone also who says, but what about our children and our grandchildren? My answer is, what about our children who are graduating from college and can't find jobs? What about our infrastructure, which is deteriorating because state and local governments aren't doing, not only are they not doing new projects, they're not even doing the maintenance that they would normally be doing. Those things are a much bigger drain on our future than anything we're doing on the deficit. What would that translate into? If you were going to say, what policy am I actually advocating? So 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, almost three and a half, when the incoming Obama administration was talking about stimulus, well, there was a lot of debate, and I was, some of you may remember if you were reading my columns at the time, I was very publicly tearing my hair out over the inadequacy of the plan, partly because it was going to be inadequate, both too small and too short-lived, and I was also worried that what did happen would happen, which was that instead, because it was being sold as the answer when it was clearly inadequate, people would say, ah, you see, stimulus fails. It doesn't work, which is how it turned out, but it was way inadequate. But there were some real problems at that time about exactly how are you going to spend the money. There was way too much talk about shovel-ready projects. If people had understood, as they should, that this was going to last for quite a while, there were a lot more things that could have been done. But still, it was a little bit hard at that point to come up with ways to spend a lot of money. Now it's not, because what we've actually been doing since then is the reverse of stimulus. What we've actually been doing is cutting back. Simple measure, it's not the only measure, but look at government employment, all levels of government, not federal. Normally, state and local employment, and by the way, when you think government workers, school teachers. Your representative government worker is a school teacher. It's school teachers and then some firefighters and some police officers, and that basically is what your government worker is. So anybody who has a picture of all these bureaucrats sitting and doing nothing, it's not. It's the young man or woman teaching your kids that we're talking about. Normally that state and local employment grows roughly with population, which, by the way, is what it did during Bush Jr.'s first term. It grew more or less in line with population. By that standard, we should have added about 700,000 jobs in state and local. That's not expansion of government. It's just keeping up, just maintaining basic government services. In fact, we've laid off 600,000. So we're right there. We're 1.3 million jobs down from where we should have been in the public sector. And because those public sector workers, if they were still employed, would have money to spend on other things, because we're really talking 2 million jobs right there. If we had not had all of these cancellations and cutbacks and deferred maintenance, all those potholes that are proliferating, I haven't driven enough here, but New Jersey is really falling apart, then we'd be spending still more. The unemployment rate, if we hadn't had this austerity, would be below 6.5%. We would be not full employment. We'd be a long way closer to full employment. So all we really need to do to get out of this is to have the federal government provide aid to the state and local governments so that they can reverse this austerity, so they can rehire those school teachers. It really is that simple. It's not a hard thing at all. There are other things you can do. I could talk about monetary policy, housing. Debt forgiveness, we've done a terrible job at providing what was debt relief that would actually be in everybody's interests. So that we should do those things too. But the central thing is just spend more, and it would be over faster than you can imagine. I do a little historical stuff. I like to look for what people were saying during the Great Depression. You can find articles, learned articles. I picked up a phrase. Actually, I picked it up from the blogger, Duncan Black. Very serious people, capital V, capital S, capital P. And the very serious people of the 1930s explained that there's no way that we could restore full employment in this modern 20th century economy, these high-tech world of the 1930s, just by spending more money. And you find articles saying that in 1939. And then the war started in Europe, and the United States began its own military buildup. And within 2 years, employment had risen 20%. That's the equivalent of 26 million jobs today. Full employment was back. It really was that easy. And the same is true now. Somebody's going to want to ask about Europe. So the Europeans, there's been a kind of a race, actually, between us and the Europeans to see who can do a worse job of dealing with this crisis. They are winning for the time being. I won't say, there'll probably be questions. Just let's say that the Europeans have on top of, they have all the same problems, the same misconceptions that we do. Slightly different, actually. Here we have a lot of people who rant on about budget deficits. Here they're mostly I think it's fair to say mostly. They're mostly actually frauds. That our deficit, alleged deficit hawks are really people who just want to find a way to strip away Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and are using the deficit as an excuse. Because if you notice, an awful lot of those deficit reduction plans start with big tax cuts for rich people. In Europe, I believe that the deficit, that's the German politicians in particular, I believe they're sincere. They really believe in economics as a morality play. They think of it, debt is evil. Actually, of course, in German, the word for debt and the word for guilt are actually the same word. But the effect has been that they've tried to solve their problems purely through imposing austerity, with the additional problem that they have a single currency without a single government. And that turns out to add a whole extra level of desperation to their situation. You look at a place here like Nevada that has had a terrible housing bubble and burst and very high unemployment. It looks exactly like Ireland, by the way. Not the scenery, but if you look at the size of the housing bubble and the rest. The difference, of course, is that retirees in Nevada get their Medicare checks, their Social Security checks from Washington. In Ireland, it's supposed to come from the government of Ireland. So there they have fiscal crises that we don't. And so their system is working even worse than ours, and now at great risk of catastrophic stuff happening. So the Europeans are an additional problem, but it's part of the broader problem. And if the Europeans, they could also get through, I don't think Greece can be saved for the euro, but the rest could be. But again, it requires clarity, requires understanding that this is not about punishing guilty parties. This is about saving the economy, which they're not willing to do. Last thing to say here, and then throw it open for the questions. So I say it's very easy to do economically. The policies are easy. We could do it fast. We could be back most of the way to full employment in 2 years. It would really be that easy. There would be no problem with financing it. But of course, how do we get past the politics? The answer to that is I can think of ways in which it might be possible to actually put my program into effect. One of them is we do have an election coming up. I always have to say, New York Times rules, I don't do endorsements, I'm not allowed to do endorsements, you have no idea which party I favor. It's still a significant possibility. If President Obama is reelected, Democrats hold the Senate, and this is less likely but not impossible, Nancy Pelosi is Speaker again, then we get a chance for a do-over and a chance to actually try and do the right thing. And that, I think, is our best, that would be the best scenario for doing this right. There's the alternative, which is that we have a Romney victory and a Republican Congress, and who knows what Romney actually believes. It's in a way, his best slogan should be, vote for Romney, he doesn't mean anything he's saying. Although I fear, and there is some, his advisors are his economic advisors are not stupid. If you actually read their textbooks, they both have textbooks, which are not as good as my textbook with Robin Wells, my wife, but they're not that different in their analysis. If you actually went by their textbooks, they'd be calling for pretty much the same kind of things I'm calling for here. But I actually suspect that there's not too much hope that Romney would do the right thing, because whatever he might believe, if anything, he won't have the freedom. Grover Norquist, the anti-tax crusader, has said the only reason we want Romney in the White House is that he has five fingers that can hold a pen to sign the stuff we put in front of him. And I'm afraid that's the way it will be. So that's not too good. What if it's Obama without a working majority in Congress, which is probably the most likely outcome right now, though all of these are real possibilities? Well, then he has to hammer on this. He has to do a Harry Truman. He has to say, these people, that do-nothing House of Representatives is what's stopping you from having a job. Because I think if there's one thing we've learned politically from these terrible 3.5 years now, it is that trying to sweep the realities of the economic situation under the rug, looking for bipartisan agreement where there is no bipartisan agreement, not telling the truth about what's going wrong, that doesn't even work as a political strategy. You've got to hit the issues. Got to make that case. And all of us need to make that case. We need to get out there and say, this does not have to be happening. This catastrophe that's happening in our society is gratuitous. It could be solved easily. We need to get that message out. We need to try and move public opinion as well as politics, which is why some of us write books. Thank you.
So you're just going to stay up there. You just stay up there.
Yeah. Just grab a glass of water.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's water down there, too.
Our thanks to Dr. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate, professor of economics at Princeton University, New York Times columnist, and author of the new book, End This Depression Now. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have quite a few questions, so let's begin. In that dream scenario where the Democrats get either the House or the Senate or both and Obama wins, what would be the first five checks that you would write?
Okay, so the big, I'm not even sure it has to be five, but the...
Okay, four.
Okay, great. It's like a reverse Monty Python amongst the checks. The first thing is a large package of aid to state and local governments. There was a substantial amount of that aid in the original, the Recovery Act, but it was short-lived. It was basically a year. Right now, you need to be providing large aid to help pay for Medicaid, for education, for infrastructure, to be spent at the state and local level so as to relax that budget constraint. And it should be open-ended. It shouldn't have a definite expiration date because the right time to end it is when the economy is sufficiently recovered that it doesn't need that anymore. I would actually put the number at about $300 billion a year of aid. That's what we should be doing. That's the biggest thing. there should be, we can do quite a lot of housing debt relief. We could do that actually really very easily. In fact, we could be doing that right now, and this is where I think the president is being too cautious. A lot of home mortgages in this country are held by Fannie and Freddie, the government-sponsored agencies. And there are lots of people who should be refinancing at lower interest rates, because interest rates are very low, who can't because they don't have sufficient equity by the Fannie-Freddie rules. You can relax those rules, temporarily waive the rules, and just the current administrator of the Federal Housing Agency is refusing to do that for whatever reason, and we can think about why that might be. But this could be... he does, actually, after all, serve at the pleasure of the president and should be just told to do it or be replaced. So we can do debt, substantial debt relief in a very simple way. There are other kinds of debt relief that are harder to engineer, including student debt, but we can make a good faith effort to do that. That's something which there has been no serious effort to provide debt relief in up till this point, and it really should be done. Monetary policy. So the president just finally filled the vacancies on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. We don't know, unfortunately, we don't know where the new guys will put. But it is possible. My former department chairman, now demoted to running the world, Ben Bernanke. Whether out of his own beliefs or out of internal politics, as the Fed has been way too cautious. And I have a paper that I've been urging him to read about things that a central bank should do in situations like this, aggressive steps that it should take. It was written actually about the Bank of Japan in the year 2000, but it was the same kind of situation. And it makes it clear that the Fed is not doing what it should. And the paper was written by a fellow named Ben Bernanke. So I want Chairman Bernanke to listen to Professor Bernanke and do the right thing. Then there are real infrastructure, longer-term projects. We should be working on alternative energy. We should be spending. You know, people have taken one trivial, you know, in the scale of things, trivial bad loan to Solyndra as a reason. Oh, let's cut out all. This is the future. We should be spending on it. I can go on my list, right? So it's
you're
it can really
past
proliferate.
Four, though. I have to say.
Right. I think the point is that to do even to just do the first one would already be transformative in the way our economy is functioning. And as we go down the list, we would be back to an astonishingly better situation. There's endless things that we need to work on beyond that. There are lots of things wrong with America. But none of those things is easier to solve when we have 13 million Americans unemployed. So get moving on this relatively short list right away.
There was a sense when the stimulus package was first announced that we would begin to see WPA type of projects all over, you know, like the St. Louis Arc, and in San Francisco, there are wonderful examples. And that did not happen. Why is that?
Okay, there was never the actual infrastructure spending bit of the stimulus of the Recovery Act was quite small. It was, and you know, it's largely invisible. I mean, you actually have to look hard to see. Once in a while, you'll see a sign. You know, at the Baltimore train station, there's a sign saying, "We're replacing the lighting with money from the Recovery Act." And there were reasons for that. Part of it was there was this excessive focus on shovel-ready, mm-hmm. stuff to be done quickly, because I have to say, and this was partly, the president did listen to the wrong people who assured him that this was going to be a short, severe recession, but not a prolonged one. And it seemed obvious to a lot of us, given the history of past financial crises, that it was actually going to be longer, and there was plenty of time. Projects that wouldn't kick in for 2 or 3 years were still worth doing. So that's one reason. Tremendous aversion. I mean, we have had the problem of being subjected to about 40 years now of incessant propaganda about the evils of government spending and the badness of government, and the government can't do anything right. A little bit, construction is a little more high-tech than it used to be. It's not quite as easy. And, well, the tone of the country. I mean, the WPA did things like employ artists. Try getting that through Congress these days, right? So I would cut a fair bit of slack, but it was harder. But the amazing thing now is we don't even need to do that. I mean, if I would be all for a WPA-type program, and I'd go for as much as we can, but we don't. Well, we can get a long way just by rehiring those damn school teachers.
As we know, the federal government can borrow and go into debt, and states can't. And you focus on the federal government, but I wonder if you could talk about what states should be doing. And this is a national broadcast, but we're sitting in California. Right. I'm sure Governor Brown would love to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Well, of course, Governor Brown, by the way, this is, I'm having real time warp problems with the idea that Jerry Brown is governor of California, being my age. And of course, he faces political constraints that are, if anything, even worse than those facing President Obama because of the craziness of California's constitutional setup. But let's say, first of all, states have responded in past downturns, states have responded with a mix of spending cuts and tax increases. This time around, it's been almost all spending cuts. And almost surely, that actually has made things worse. So it is a bad thing. There have also been a fair number of gratuitous cuts. Although states have been forced to do a lot of contracting, some have done more than others without obvious reason. So very interesting factoid. If you look at those cuts in government employment, they have been concentrated in states that switched in 2010, that switched from Democratic to Republican control. So about 70% of the job cuts are either in the, I think it's 11 states that switched control, or in Texas. So there are choices. There's no question that even with the best will in the world, that even a governor who totally agrees with everything I've written in this book is going to have very limited room for maneuver, but there is some room for maneuver. By the way, it's the same in Europe. If you're the prime minister of a small European country, you do have an option that a U.S. state doesn't have, which is leaving the euro. But that is an extreme nuclear option, which will be invoked only if the worst is happening, which may be just around the corner. Not so much you can do. But finally, of course, you should be thinking about the future. Only people who sag worry about the future. There ought to be priorities on things that are long-term investments that are going to matter. Of course, I have my pet peeve, which is not just trivial, but it's actually the biggest infrastructure project in America, and one of the most needed, was just canceled by my governor, known locally as Governor Yells at People of New Jersey, who has decided, based on with almost no money saved, to cancel. The greatest city in the world is linked to the West by one rail tunnel, which was completed in 1910 and runs at 100% of capacity during rush hour, and we're not going to build a replacement? Incredible. So there's some room for maneuver, but fundamentally this is a Washington issue. But state governors can at least try to mitigate the impacts a little bit.
But your state governor is actually considered one of the most popular and electable Republicans today in the United States. So I just wonder, do you think there's appetite on the American people to actually vote for someone who says, I'm going to have to raise your taxes and I'm going to spend for stimulus?
I think there's, we had a little bit of a political lesson last fall. The President Obama came out with a job creation proposal. It was a fairly modest thing, but it was bigger than expected. It came out as a stronger plan, significantly stronger than rumor had it. And it turns out that there was a lot of internal debate in the White House with a lot of the political people saying, oh, no, that's too big a number, it'll hurt. Turned out he went up in the polls because he actually showed that he stood for something. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said for actually standing for something. Obama spent most of 2011 saying, basically, I agree with the Republicans, but I'm going to do it less so. And that didn't work even as a political strategy. And by actually standing for something, it mattered. And if you are in a position to actually put policies into effect, then the important thing to remember is that voters, whatever voters may say in focus groups or whatever, they vote on results. FDR, his greatest mistake was that in 1936, polls said that people wanted to balance the budget and cut government spending. And he went ahead and did it in 1937. Sending the economy into the second great leg of the Great Depression, and lost terribly in the 1938 midterm elections. So what he should have remembered is, do what's right for the economy, the votes will follow, not what voters say they think they want. Because people have lives, they have children, they have jobs, they don't think a lot about macroeconomics. What they look at is they say, is this government working?
Right. There does seem to be some economists in the room who want to know the possibility of inflation based on the kinds of remedies that you're addressing, and is that a worrisome?
No, actually, some inflation would be helpful. Some inflation would be a way to both reduce the attractiveness of sitting on cash. Because what's happening right now is that those players in the economy who are not in debt. Are just sitting on cash, which they're doing for pretty good reasons, but we wish they would do less of it. So particularly the corporate sector is sitting on something like $2 trillion of cash, which is not out of something nefarious, and by the way, it's not because they're afraid of that socialist in the White House. It's because why build new factories and new office buildings when the ones you have are sitting idle because of lack of demand? But sitting on cash would be less attractive if you expect there to be some inflation. Also, a little bit of inflation erodes debt, reduces it a bit. Okay, quick history lesson. We know that World War II ended the Great Depression. One question, though, is why didn't we relapse back into the Great Depression when the war was over? A lot of people thought we would. Actually, Montgomery Ward, which was once a big chain, basically lost its grip, became a minor player, and then eventually went under because its CEO bet everything on the notion that there'd be a return to the Depression. So instead of expanding, he just built up a pile of cash. And of course, the Depression did not come back. And as best we can tell, one of the main reasons the Great Depression did not come back is that there was some inflation during the war. There was also, of course, a boom and people couldn't borrow, so they paid down debt. But also, by the time the war was over and the price controls had been lifted, the consumer price index was about 60% higher than it had been before the war, which meant that the real value of debt was down and the economy was much better positioned for recovery. So some inflation would be a good thing. People who think that there's going to be runaway inflation, they're just not looking at the situation. They're not looking at the lessons of history. Those of us who studied Japan in the Japan basically did a dress rehearsal for our crisis in, starting in the 1990s, and they had, you know, they printed a lot of money and it did nothing. They stayed in deflation, and it was totally predictable the same thing would happen now. It's the inflation worriers have been predicting inflation breaking out, you know, for 3 years, and high inflation, and it never happens. They've also, of course, been predicting interest rates soaring for 3 years, and it keeps not happening. And you would think this would make some of them at least you know, reconsider. Maybe their model of how the world works isn't right. But actually, my lesson is for 12 years of writing columns is essentially nobody ever admits that they were wrong about anything. But still, but they were wrong. And those of us who went with the time-tested analysis of what happens, of what depression economics is like, have been by and large right about what was going to happen.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guest is Nobel laureate economist and New York Times columnist Dr. Paul Krugman, who is discussing the current state and future of the U.S. economy. Dr. Krugman, can you talk a little bit about banking reform and what role that plays in our economic recovery?
Okay, wow. yeah. In a way, it's a good thing, but the fact of when you have a crisis of this magnitude, there are just so many things you can talk about. Although the basics are simple, but there's a lot of stuff that isn't simple that goes with it. Okay, banking. Banks are dangerous, useful but dangerous. They make it possible for people to have liquidity, ready access to their money, but at the same time, they make it possible for those savings to be used for longer-term, more productive investments. This is a good thing, by and large, but it can go terribly wrong because if a bank gets in trouble, or even if there's just a rumor that a bank is in trouble, people try to pull their money out. There's a bank run, and the bank collapses. And so banks need to be regulated. They need to be limited in the kinds of risks they can take. They need to be supported. You need things like deposit insurance. And we've known this forever. If you actually go back and read Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, 1776, the book that starts economics, he has a section about the need to regulate banks carefully because Scotland basically invented modern banking and therefore actually invented modern banking crises back in the 18th century. So all of this is stuff we used to know, and a lot of what we've had is a great forgetting, and we forgot those rules, or we were, you know, or some people were lavishly paid to forget those rules, and so we developed a very dangerous, unstable banking system. Fixing that system doesn't bring us out of the depression we're in, because at this point the problem is actually not the banks anymore. The problem is the overhang of debt on the part of households, and that's what's holding us down now. But certainly want to fix them so we don't do it all over again. We had financial reform legislation, Dodd-Frank, which is a lot weaker than we should have had, but is a lot better than nothing at all. And if it were fully in place, it might have prevented the risk-taking that just turned J.P. Morgan into a cautionary tale, which is a useful one, by the way. I'm actually very grateful to Jamie Dimon, because he was out there posing as the responsible banker and saying, see, people like me know what we're doing. We don't need to be carefully regulated. And, well, it turns out, yes, you do. So that was very helpful. And so we need more of that, much more. And because otherwise, we will just do this all over again. Actually, what was really striking as we're getting more details about the J.P. Morgan story is that what they were doing, the kinds of risky investments they were making, not only were they taking risks like banks did just before the big crisis, they were taking the same risks. They bought almost half of the mortgage-backed securities in Britain. My God, it's, you know, the same stuff. So they're actually, it's as if they were determined to have a repeat, remake that movie when the first one's still in the theaters,
and not showing well.
Right. This is going to be crucial. Because we could do it all over again and again. As you know, I have. You don't know at all who I prefer in the election, but Mitt Romney has promised to repeal Dodd-Frank. So take away even the inadequate, but at least step in the right direction regulation and get rid of it. Incredible.
Do you think that Glass-Steagall should be reinstated?
Yeah. So Glass-Steagall, people, Glass-Steagall was the 1930s legislation that separated commercial banking from investment banking. It said that if you're a bank that takes deposits, you cannot be also doing wheeling and dealing. And clearly, there was a good reason for that, because the depository institutions are where you can have a severe bank run problem, and so they should not be engaged in the kind of risky activities that make those things more likely. Now, what is true is that even if Glass-Steagall had been left in place, and it was repealed in 1999, we still would have been vulnerable to this crisis, because a lot of what happened involved shadow banks, is the term everybody uses now, involved institutions that were doing banking but without depository institutions. So Lehman Brothers was not, Glass-Steagall didn't affect, would never have affected Lehman Brothers. But Lehman Brothers, what it was doing was it was borrowing, it was financing itself through repo, essentially overnight loans, but using that the money it raised to make longer-term investments, which is fundamentally the same thing as a bank that takes deposits and then lends money out long-term to households and businesses. But because it wasn't strictly deposits, it wasn't regulated, it wasn't controlled. So what we really needed was not just to maintain Glass-Steagall, but we needed to extend the principles of Glass-Steagall to shadow banking as well. So it would have taken a lot more than just keeping Glass-Steagall, but it was certainly did not help. Some of the institutions that got us into this mess were institutions that would have been somewhat constrained if we hadn't gotten rid of Glass-Steagall. And more important, the spirit. You know, our grandfathers knew what they were doing. They responded to the banking crisis of the 1930s by doing the right things to prevent a recurrence. And for 50 years, there was no recurrence. And then we proceeded to tear up everything we'd learned and create the... You know, and set ourselves up for what, in fact, did happen.
There's a question about, actually several, about how the government is going to generate revenue. And you talk right. about not it being a problem to borrow, but they talk about taxing the very wealthy, which a number of people have said, even if you do that, it's nowhere near enough.
That's right. And, you know, so we will someday be out of this, and we'll need to raise enough revenue to pay for the government's activities. And taxing the very wealthy, it's not trivial. It's not a tiny sum of money. I mean, they used to say, oh, there just isn't that much money at the top, but you know, now there is. And there's very good arguments to say actually that the top, the very highest incomes should be taxed not just back to Clinton-era levels, but substantially higher than that. So the actual effective tax rate on the highest incomes now is about 43%, we think, that's including state and local. And the best estimates I've seen that carefully work it through say that it should be more like 70. But that's very highest incomes. But even that, that's not enough. So we're going to need more revenue. And you can do that in various ways. I mean, the truth is even the middle class parts of the Bush tax cuts were a mistake. We couldn't afford that. Probably we're going to need more. If you look at countries that have got a much more effective social safety net than we do, pretty much all of them do have a value-added tax that pays for it. And a VAT, which is basically a national sales tax, yeah, it's somewhat regressive. It tends to be paid a little bit more heavily by people with lower incomes. But if it's used to finance national health insurance, generous unemployment benefits, family aid, the net effect is actually very progressive. So if you actually look at the Swedish tax system, it's actually a little bit less tilted towards the top than ours, or it's within the range of uncertainty because of the difficulty of calculating these things. But the main thing is it pays for a much more effective anti-poverty, anti-misery system than we have. So I'm willing to consider, say that, look, if we need a VAT to make the numbers add up, fine. The important thing is to preserve and extend the social safety net. If that requires somewhat more taxes, fine. Doesn't have to be, you know. We have close to the lowest tax overall tax burden of any advanced country, and we shouldn't. We should be doing. We don't have to go all the way. We don't have to be Sweden. We don't have to be France. But I would actually be happy if we could move halfway to being Canada. Just to have a more decent, a more just society.
Do you think that the increasing income disparity between the rich and the poor is a symptom or a driver of the crisis now?
Well, I think it's actually a couple of pieces there. It probably played a role in causing the crisis, though that's a little bit tricky. It probably played a role because the increasing disparity meant that middle class families were left behind, and some of them were in effect pushed into borrowing. Just if you actually go and look at where did Elizabeth Warren come into this stuff? She actually came into it with a study of family bankruptcies and found that families were going bankrupt not because they were living high and buying expensive TVs, but because they were trying desperately to buy houses in good school districts. And so that was income inequality that was really driving that. So that's certainly part of the story. I think the really important thing is income inequality is at the core of our political dysfunction. There's a very close relationship historically between income inequality and political polarization. This extreme disparity between the parties is driven by the extreme disparity among Americans, where a tiny minority at the top has, in effect, bought itself one of our two great political parties and moved it way off to the right. And that political polarization has paralyzed our response to the crisis, plus a lot of the propagandizing about how government can do nothing good and there can be no possible role for government in fighting unemployment. That comes out of an incessant campaign from think tanks that are financed by the same people. And it's actually kind of, you know, if you actually look at that network, look who's been preaching these doctrines, it's really about a dozen billionaires behind the whole thing. So it's not a complicated story. So that's so the income inequality played some role in setting the stage for the crisis directly, some role in setting the stage for the crisis by pushing for bank deregulation and other things, and then a major role, critical role, in making our response to the crisis as bad as it has been.
You have written before quite a bit about the need for healthcare reform and how healthcare reform would contribute positively to the economy. Given the passage of the Health Care Reform Act and the results, I mean, the political fallout from that, do you reevaluate your position at all?
No, I don't think so. First of all, I think that the lousy economy is probably the main explanation of what happened in the midterms. And look, there really was one chance to get health care reform passed. If we didn't do it in 2010, don't know when the next opportunity would have come. Now, we might lose it, and that scares me. We might lose it either because of a politicized Supreme Court or because President Romney undoes it. But you had to make that try because, you know, ultimately, politics is not about winning elections. Politics is about trying to make your country better. And healthcare reform is something we needed. And this healthcare reform, it's not the healthcare reform anyone would have designed from scratch. It really is. It's a Rube Goldberg device, but it's improvable. And if we can get the principle of universal coverage established, then I think we can do a great deal. Then we can make that system better, and it's actually even good for the budget because in the end, it's only through a universal system that we're going to be able to get healthcare costs under control.
Okay, I just. The Clinton welfare reform policies were lauded because they put caps or exits onto the benefits that were received. What's your feeling about that? And was that a good thing? And do you subscribe to putting caps on those benefits that you now want to send out to people through an increased stimulus?
Okay. The welfare reform, the trouble with the welfare reform was that it was very rigid. The question was, what would it do in the face of a prolonged economic downturn? What happens when we require that people go out and get jobs, but there are no jobs? This was always the nightmare. And we didn't get a proper test of that because the Clinton-era economy was really very good, and the Bush-era economy, although not so good, wasn't terrible enough to put full stress test on until now, until the end, until the final year of the Bush administration. And now we're seeing it, now that the TANF, the welfare reform program, is failing terribly. It's people are being cut off with no place to turn, really. The saving grace of the system has turned out to be actually food stamps have been a critical lifeline here. Without the food stamp program, wow, we would be in seeing incredible misery, even worse than we are seeing. But that's not a perfect substitute. And all of these other things, actually, let me say another point. Aside from, no, I don't think we want to put rigid caps. This is benefits that are emergency benefits should depend not on some arbitrary timeline for the individual, but on the duration of the emergency. So while, you know, you don't cut off, if we've had a flood, you don't say, well, we're only going to help flood victims for 3 days. You say we're going to help them until the flood recedes, right? And that's what you want to do. The other thing to say is, it's one of those funny things. Everybody on the right claims to worry a lot about incentives in our society. They're terribly worried that raising the tax rate on rich people by one percentage point is going to do terrible things and make them stop creating jobs. If you actually look at where the really bad incentives created by our system are, they're actually at the bottom, because we have all of these means-tested benefits that are withdrawn much too soon. So somebody who makes just a little bit more money and gets their income up from $18,000 to $20,000 ends up losing a lot of benefits. In effect, ends up paying marginal tax rates of 80, 90%. So less means testing is actually a way to improve our incentives, to make the market work better. It's a complete misunderstanding of what the proper role of limits on government programs should be.
There's quite a few people who want to know what they should do. So here you've got a call to action. What should they do?
Okay. obviously, write your congressperson. Obviously,
our congressperson already agrees with
you. Right. work for what you believe in. I think that's general advice. You know, not just, of course, vote, but also not just show up at the polling place, but work for a campaign. And let me say, a lot of what happens here, the role of the news media is very important. What people actually hear depends a great deal on what gets through the news media. And there has been this terrible epidemic of false equivalency, or just plain, instead of reporting the facts, they simply report Democrats said this, Republicans say that. And so write to reporters, write to news organizations when they get it wrong. Because there's one thing I know that people may not know is that many people in the news media have incredibly thin skins. They're completely unaccustomed, or put it this way, they've been trained to be terribly afraid of the right wing. And they're shocked and horrified when they start to get criticism from progressives. And they yell and they scream and they complain, and then they start doing better reporting. Oh, and by the way, I don't have a thin skin. I did when I started, but now rhinoceroses have got nothing on me.
Okay. We've reached the time in our program where there's one more question, and I'm going to go ahead and ask a personal question. When one reads about you, it's often commented that you prefer to be behind the scenes, that you really don't like to be in the limelight, and that you're kind of a shy guy.
Which is actually true, believe it or not.
So it must have been quite a decision-making process for you to decide to essentially be out in the vanguard in terms of this, your thoughts and this these policies. Can you help us to understand what you went through to make the decision to be out there like you are?
Wow. I'm trying to figure out a way to answer this without sounding like I'm trying to be holier than thou. But
it's okay.
This is a moral issue. Right? What's happening now is not just bad management. It's not something we should be doing technically better. What's happening is terrible. We're condemning tens of millions of our fellow citizens to a nightmare unnecessarily. And if you think you can make it better, if you can think you can get the message out that it can be made better, then your personal comfort ought not to weigh into things. You ought to stand up and say what you believe and get that message out. And so, like I said, it's hard to, you know, heroic I'm not, but I don't think I could live with myself if I wasn't trying to get this message out.
Our thanks to Dr. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate, professor of economics in Princeton, New York Times columnist, author of the new book, End This Depression Now, and clearly an inspiration to all of us. We thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.